Yeah, let's get started with the conflict, with the current situation of the conflict in Ukraine. Lukashenko, in his recent meeting with Putin, said that we are not escalating the situation, but we must be prepared not to miss a strike from the West. And Ray, when you look at the situation right now, we've heard that Victoria Nuland on ABC News, she was advocating to help Ukraine to hit some targets inside Russia. The same thing was repeated by Antony Blinken, that we have to help Ukrainians to do that. And how far, in your opinion, how far the West is willing to go? We know that the EU has already gone too far.
Nima, those are the $64 questions, as we say in the States. That interview yesterday, I'm glad you keep up as well as I do with these things. That was key. That was big. Among the things that Putin said is that Zelensky is not legal. He's not the legal representative of Ukraine. So with whom are we to deal? We are open to negotiations. We have proven that, says Putin. We did negotiate. That was March, April of 2022, just weeks after the special military operation or the Russian invasion, depending on how you look at it, started. In other words, what Putin is saying sotto voce is, we wanted to scare the hell out of Zelensky, and we did. We surrounded Kiev, and they met with us in Belarus first, and then we moved those negotiations to Ukraine, and we worked out a deal. First and foremost, Ukraine would be neutral. We'd stop the fighting, and we'd deal with the other stuff later. That was what our priorities were. It was initialed by the Ukrainian negotiators who are part of Zelensky's party, actually head of the faction in Zelensky's party there in the Rada, in the Ukrainian parliament. And they attest to the fact that this was all signed, sealed, and delivered, except for a few things that needed to be worked out. And Boris Johnson, on behalf of the United States and the UK, came in and said, look, Zelensky, no deal. You can't do this, okay? Because if you do this, we're not going to give you any help. And we're the UK and the United States of America. We will support you for as long as it takes against those dirty Russians, okay? Zelensky made a very, very large mistakes. He's a comedian. He doesn't know much about geography. I mean, for God's sake, even Obama, who's not a comedian but knows about geography, said, and I quote this, 2015, President Obama, the worst thing we can do is to give the Ukrainians the idea that they could prevail against a much stronger Russia. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, the Deputy Secretary of State at the time, under Obama, said he spelled it out and he said, any military aid, which Obama refused to give, offensive military weaponry that we gave to Ukraine would be, quote, matched, doubled, and tripled, and quadrupled by Russia. Who is it that said that as Deputy Secretary of State under Obama? That was Antony Blinken. Now, why he changed his mind? Did the geography change? Did Russia's industrial capability change? No. What happened was a very naive person came in named Joe Biden. He didn't really get much of this by himself. And so he was a tool in the hands of Blinken and Sullivan. And he just listened to them. Yeah, sure, we'll give Russia a bloody nose. Well, we know how that all came out, right? And so what Putin is saying yesterday with Lukashenko in Belarus is, look, we have this alliance. It's really one state, Belarus and Russia. And we've coordinated our defense apparatus to include tactical nuclear weapons. We're exercising them. We're exercising them together. That's new, okay? But we're ready for whatever happens. Now, Nima, I just have to say that I don't like to be surprised, okay? I thought I know a lot about Putin and about the Russian leadership. I was surprised when he went into Ukraine. Why? Because I didn't think he'd do that alone. And I didn't think that the Chinese would countenance that, would support that. I had assiduously cultivated many Chinese analysts, American analysts and British analysts of Chinese affairs, and said, would Xi Jinping ever condone an invasion of Ukraine? And, oh, come on, Westphalia, Westphalia, that's Chinese bedrock principle, okay? So I got that wrong. That's my excuse, okay? I didn't think Putin would do that alone. He didn't do it alone. He had Xi Jinping on his back. Now he has Xi Jinping folded at the hip with him to include Xi Jinping's silence on what Putin said about the use and the exercise of tactical, he calls them non-strategic nuclear weapons. Those exercises have been going on the last few days. I would have thought that if China had any reservations about that, they would have made that clear, all the more so since Putin announced these moves well before he went to Beijing. So, what's the situation here? Zelensky is no longer a legitimate ruler. That ran out on the 20th of May. Belarus and Russia are joined in a union. That's what they call it, a union. That's the equivalent of a one state, and they're exercising tactical nuclear weapons together. And China has no problem with that. Why? Because China realizes that it's enemy number one. And what NATO and the U.S. is trying to do is get rid of this Russia problem in Ukraine. And, you know, the big deal is go after China. Lots of money in that for the defense contractors. And we want to rebuild our naval fleet to match, get this, to match what China has now. In other words, China has not been sitting around idle over the last decade. They have built a navy that's a formidable defense navy against U.S., the Seventh Fleet that has earlier had complete domain over the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits. Last thing I'll mention is that you may recall that for 2 years I've been saying that if the Russians get involved in a dust-up with NATO, with the U.S. and the West, or perhaps in Syria, somewhere else, the Chinese are going to do more than just rattle sabers out there in the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits. And since you're up on the news, you probably know that over the last couple of days, Taiwan has been surrounded by Chinese naval exercises. The aircraft are flying all over Taiwan. The Chinese are making a point. Look, don't even think of reneging on your promise of 53 years ago of one China to include Taiwan. And don't even think of trying to mess around with those islands in the South China Sea that we claim and that we have international law behind us to assert and to verify and affirm those claims, which happens to be the case, I've learned belatedly.
Yeah. You've mentioned that the Zelensky's terms is over, but he's continuing under the martial law. We're hearing that Poroshenko is not happy with the situation in Ukraine. How do you see what's going on in Ukraine right now? How do you see the position of Zelensky and the way that the United States is trying to manage the political parties, the political movements inside Ukraine?
Well, one of the interesting things that I forgot to mention just now is that Yanukovych, remember him? Yanukovych, duly elected president of Ukraine until he was overthrown by the U.S.-sponsored coup in February of 2014. He shows up in Belarus during these talks between Belarus and between Lukashenko and Putin. What's that all about? You know, what's that all about? Well, I don't know, but he is the last legal president of Ukraine. Putin, Lukashenko, and Xi Jinping, and I think we can look at those as sort of an entente here. They're going to stand by one another no matter what happens. They just don't know how sensible Biden's advisors may turn out to be in the longer run. Now, they know that even when Biden follows his best instincts, that he was able to make a sensible decision, at least at one point during this whole imbroglio. And what I refer to, and what I've referred to in the past, is when Putin called at the White House on the 30th of December, 2021, and said, look, I have to talk to President Biden right away. Well, Biden was sensible, and to his credit, he took the call. Where was he? Oh, he was in Delaware. Oh, yeah, it was sort of, you know, around New Year's Eve time. Who was with him? This is it. We don't know. He may have been alone. Okay. Now, after one of these summits, there's always a readout by a senior national security figure. In this case, almost certainly it was Sullivan, perhaps Blinken. Now, they told the press nothing happened. The press asked, who was with him? Oh, well, we'll let the PR people tell you who was with him. The PR people never said who was with him. The PR people put out this ridiculous thing saying, well, it was a nice conversation, but nothing happened. So did Jake Sullivan or Blinken, whoever it was that was speaking, but nothing happened here, okay? And guess what? The Russian readout. And, you know, it can depend on Russian readouts of summits to be legitimate. I can speak from 60 years of that experience, okay? They said that Biden undertook, what Biden said was, the U.S. has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. Okay, in Ukraine. The capsules for such are already in Romania and Poland. You put them in Ukraine, you shorten the distance, send off to a target to about 5 minutes. So Putin was really interested in getting an undertaking personally from the President of the United States. Look, we know you got capsules that can accommodate these missiles in Poland and Romania. Please, please. I've told my top leaders, my military leaders, says Putin, that you're going to put them in Ukraine. They came back to me and said, that we will not tolerate. So, Mr. President, with these bilateral negotiations that we have starting on the 9th and 10th of January, just 10 days away, it would be really, really good if you could just give me an assurance right now on the telephone that you have no intention of putting offensive strike missiles, you know, intermediate range ballistic missiles in Ukraine. Can you do that? And Biden, well, I'm sure Biden said, oh, sounds good to me. Well, it didn't sound good to Sullivan. It didn't sound good to Blinken. And so when Blinken meets with Lavrov just 3 weeks later, namely on the 21st of January, 2022, you know, 2000, so what's that, about a month before the special military operation. So Lavrov says to Blinken, so let's get down to brass tacks about this undertaking that your president made not to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. And Blinken says, forget about it. We assert the right to put those offensive missiles in Ukraine. Maybe we could talk about limiting them to a couple or three, limiting the number, but no, we have no, there's no undertaking by us to not put offensive missiles in Ukraine. Now, one last thing here, Biden and Putin talked again on the 12th of February. So we're talking the 30th of December, Biden's pledge. The 21st of January, Blinken's reneging on that pledge. The 12th of February, Biden and Putin again on the phone. And the readout from that came and said, Mr. Biden was unwilling to give any undertaking on two issues that are of extreme moment to us. First, non-membership for Ukraine in NATO, and second, the deployment of strike missiles, offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. So that was the 12th of February. At the next day, the shelling of Lugansk and Donetsk increased from 500 shellings a day to 1,300 shellings. No, 13,000 shellings by 5 days later. Now, on the 24th, of course, Putin went into, sent his forces into Ukraine. So that's the background of all this. So what am I saying? I'm saying they don't trust us. They don't trust what the president of the United States says, okay? So when they and Lukashenko and Xi Jinping all look at this stuff, they say, well, Biden came through once for us. Let's adopt a reasonable attitude. And as Putin also said yesterday with Lukashenko in Belarus, we're ready to negotiate. We proved that way back in March, April of 2022, just 6 weeks into the special military operation. We're willing to do that again based on the current array of forces. Now, would they really settle for not taking all of Donetsk province? I don't know about that, but this is about negotiations, right? This is about give and take, something that the Biden administration is not used to. So this is, I think, a bona fide overture saying, look, we're willing to talk. We never said we were not willing to talk, but we're not willing to talk to that illegal president of Ukraine. We have the legal one right here. His name is Lukashenko, okay? And actually, if you think that this peace conference in Switzerland that's going to be held in the middle of June, like the 15th and 16th of June, if you think that's going to amount to anything, well, forget about it. The Chinese have decided not to come. The Americans are not. The president of the United States is not coming. What do you hope to achieve there if key, of course, Russia has not even been invited? So what do you expect to achieve there? In the background, be assured, we're willing to negotiate, just not with this illegal guy. And we're willing to go back to the lines that exist now. Of course, they're much, much more disadvantageous to the Ukrainians, given the gains that Russian forces have made. But let's start there, okay? Now, could Biden face up to that? I think the chances are 90% that he cannot. Why? Because he's got Nuland, he's got Lindsey Graham, he's got Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and a lot of the Congress saying, no, 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 we got to do this. We got to do this militarily. We have to hit Russia. We have to give the weapons that Ukraine can use to hit Russia. You know, that's what we're going to do. Now, the Russians have suffered some losses. Some of their air defense things didn't work just 2 days ago. So the question I have is, how careful, how gradual can Putin be assured of being in the next month or two? He's got his own military breathing down his back. They made him call Biden on 30 December 2021, I'm convinced. I mean, he had told them, look, 5 minutes, I'd have to decide whether to blow up the rest of the world, really. Okay, so he's got his own military, and then he's got China, and he's got Belarus in tandem. And when I said I don't like to be surprised by what the Russians do. Well, I explained why I was surprised that the Russians sent their forces into Ukraine. I hadn't given appropriate weight to the Chinese support factor. But I also am very surprised that the Russians are now brandishing, exercising strategic, non-strategic, they call them, non-strategic nuclear weaponry, read offensive strike missiles, read tactical nuclear missiles. So McGovern tries to learn from these mistakes, right? Learn from his surprises. And the lesson I've just learned is Putin is deadly serious, okay? He's really deadly serious. And if it comes to more than just pinpricks, if it comes to the Ukrainians using U.S. arms to destroy a major Russian base, then he'll be under great pressure to retaliate in a way he hasn't before. I don't think he'll use these tactical nuclear weapons, but the fact that he's exercising them, doesn't that give a lesson to these people in Western Europe and Blinken and Sullivan? Well, one would hope so, but so far they've had a tin ear to all this. They're still enveloped in their exceptionalism, their infantile disorder, which was discussed about before. And last but not least, this rules-based international order. Now, Chaz Freeman, on your program, did a beautiful job of drawing the distinction between what we used to have, you know, at least we used to have after World War II, when the UN was set up, we had an international regime of law. Okay, the law was agreed upon by the countries, and they observed this rule of law, as opposed to rule by law, which is what dictators and people who think they're exceptional think they can do. So we're a far cry from the original post-World War II international rule of law. We're now ruled by law, and we have a president who, last but not least, is running for re-election. He's going to be molded in his decision-making by what he has to do to mollify people like not only Lindsey Graham, but Mike Johnson, for God's sake. And he's got Nuland harping in the background. He's got all kinds of people saying, you can't be a coward here. You got to make decisions, okay? And, you know, I'll just go back to one more thing. And that is two years ago, Biden was down in Florida after a really devastating hurricane, okay? And the mayor came up to him and he said, "Oh, thanks for coming, President Biden. We really appreciate this. But, you know, I just have to say, that I'm so happy and so proud of you for facing down those Russians in Ukraine." Okay? And Biden, overheard on the mic, says, "You're right about that. Nobody F's." I won't say the word. You know what it is. It's got four letters. Nobody F's with a Biden. Now, if you have that kind of attitude and you've grown up adoring the likes of Madeleine Albright, advertising the fact that we're not only exceptional, but indispensable, and that the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 is somehow worth it, well, then you think the deaths of how many Palestinian children in Rafah and Gaza will be worth it. So it's a real puzzle. What we have now is a raid against the U.S. and the West is a combination of not only the union of Russia and Belarus, but China in the background. China with its own nuclear capability. And maybe I just mentioned one other thing, throw it in the mix here. Another thing that McGovern was surprised at was to find out that Russia gave North Korea, of all places, one of its most sophisticated intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, I think the North Koreans call it this Hangsang 18, okay? But the Russian nomenclature is Topol M, okay? What's the big deal here? It's solid fueled. What does that mean? That means it can be mobile. It can go into forests. You can't find it. Even these sophisticated satellites, even with X-ray, even with that infrared stuff and mobile and radar and addition to photography, they can't find these things, okay? Because they're mobile. That's new. That's why they're solid fueled, okay? What can they do? They can reach every inch of the United States. Oh, with one warhead? No. With multiple warheads and with chaff to throw off any defenses, with decoys up to a fairly well. That's what this Topol M can do. It's already been exercised in North Korea. It was brought to the attention of Jake Sullivan at a White House press conference. He said, oh, yeah, we know about that. Our intelligence analysts are looking into that. But not a word has been said since then. And that is a deliberate, I think, obfuscation or denial of the fact that Putin has done this as well as other things. Surprised McGovern, surprised everybody, I think, that North Korea would be the recipient of this kind of sophisticated ICBM. Again, capable of reaching all of the territory of the United States, as well as Hawaii, of course, and Alaska. So what am I saying? I'm saying that be prepared for some surprises. Don't be despondent because they're surprises, but learn from them, for God's sake. And the lesson in sum is that the Russians are damn serious. And when they exercise tactical nuclear weapons, when they give strategic nuclear weapons to a place like North Korea, they mean business, and they're not going to sit back and let the U.S. run roughshod over Ukraine. Ukraine is pretty much done. The war is almost completely lost. The only question is, would he follow up? If there was any ounce of receptivity on the part of Washington, would he say, okay, I made this yesterday on the 24th of May, I made this suggestion. We're willing to negotiate on the basis of what the lay of the land is now, where our forces are and where yours are. Are you willing to do this, or do you want to continue this thing? So that's the offer on the table. I think it should be taken seriously. It will be a negotiation process, as I say. We'll have to see what the Russians would settle for. One thing that would be indispensable, of course, would be a cordon sanitaire, a buffer zone that would protect what the Russians end up having from, well, would have to be 200, 300 miles now, given the attack of missiles and the HIMARS and all that stuff. So, but these things could be worked out, okay? It's just that will Biden be told by these sophomores around him that, you know, with the election coming up, Putin has the potential to have a definitive win in Ukraine? That wouldn't be good for us. We might lose the election. And then, Mr. President, as you know, not only your son has all this evidence against them, not only Hunter, but they got stuff on Blinken. They got stuff on Jake Sullivan. And so, you know, we have a personal stake in this. So let's think about whether we should wind this thing down before Putin takes over the whole place and appoints Yanukovych, the last legitimate president of Ukraine, back into power. Sorry to be so long-winded, but a lot of stuff happening here, and thanks for giving me the time to expatiate on this.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Ray. Did you saw that Boris Johnson invited a number of Azov battalions, and he was talking with them and saying, give them attackams, did give them whatever they need to attack Russia. And it was so amazing to see Ben Wallace in the picture, in the background.
Yeah. Well, those photos of Boris Johnson in Parliament with these Azov Battalion neo-Nazi figures with Nazi symbology, for God's sake. There's no question but that this is beyond the pale in my view, and that this is why one of the principal Russian objectives is not only demilitarization, that is defeating whatever the Ukrainian forces can be put up against Russia, and that in my view is 90% complete, but also de Nazification. Putin very much very clear at the very outset, those twin objectives need to be achieved before we give up, before we stop. Okay, not going to give up. So what does it mean that Boris Johnson and all these other people think that these Nazis, they're called neo-Nazis or proto-Nazis or Nazi inclined? Well, no, they have the Nazi symbols. And they're wine and dined in the British Parliament. What does that mean? Well, I don't know what it means, except what it means to Russia is that their second objective has been far from achieved, and they're going to have to remove this illegal president now, whose legality, even in the beginning, was pseudo or very dubious, but on the, what is it, 2 days ago, lost any legality because there's supposed to be a new president. So, will the Russians insist that whatever regime comes into Kiev will be not a Nazi regime? Well, they will try to. But it's a tough slog because these people are the ones that have been urging Zelensky and the Americans to not give up. Now we gotta face down these Russians. And of course, back at the ranch, back in the US Congress, there's this woeful misconception of what Russia's aims are. Now, you can say to a fare-thee-well that the Russians don't particularly want a whole bunch of territory in Ukraine, okay? And somebody will say, well, how do you know that? Well, I know that because they settled. They settled in March, April 2022, just 6 weeks after the war started. They settled for less. They settled for a deal which Ukraine would pledge to remain neutral. There would be a ceasefire, and they could work out this business about Donetsk and Luhansk and even Crimea later. That's how I know that the Russians don't covet a lot of territory in Ukraine. As you know, Nima, I've been saying for a long time, contrary to most observers, that I thought Putin would settle for not going as far as the Dnieper River. Now, most people think, well, now military dictate would ha he would have to go to the Dnieper River. I think he'd be able to negotiate that. You know, I also think Odessa, even though a traditional historical Russian city. I think that Putin, if his generals let him do it, I think he'll be willing to deal on Odessa as well. He pretty much said so a year and a half ago in one of these very long Q&As, and I've talked about that before. See, Odessa is key to a viable Ukraine. And if the Russians could get a neutral Ukraine and not beholden to the likes of Boris Johnson or his Nazi guests, I believe that the Russians would settle for maybe a joint regulation of Odessa so that a neutral Ukraine would not be a basket case, would not be simply a breadbasket, if you put it that way, for the rest of Europe, but would have access to the Black Sea and for, for commercial relations with the rest of the world. Now, that hasn't been tried because nobody rose to that occasion and said, what do you mean by that, Mr. Putin? What do you mean by the fact that, as he put it, Odessa could be a, oh, yeah, a Yablaka Razdora? Yablaka is apple, okay? Razdor, discord, okay? So go back to the Trojan War, for God's sake. An apple of discord. So Odessa could be an apple of discord or a way of coming together, meeting mutual interests, and having a peaceful resolution. Putin said that. The end of October 2022, okay? Now, why did nobody pick him up on that? Because I guess these advisors to Biden said, no, we can do a lot better than that. We can drive them back. They can drive them out of Ukraine, you know? So maybe now they've gotten religion, so to speak. Maybe now they see that the balance of forces is so much in favor of the Russian army that they'd be willing to deal. But the big thing is the election. And the calculation would be, what's best for Biden in terms of doing a deal or losing in a definitive way, losing the war in Ukraine, despite all this billions and billions of dollars, and having to face into an election period where his opponents would say, ah, okay, remember those people that lost China? Remember those people that lost Vietnam? Now, here's the guy that lost Ukraine. His name is Biden. Now, if that happens, Mr. Biden, says Blinken, or says Sullivan, we're done. We're out of there. And as I would remind you again, Mr. President, they have the goods on us, okay? Not only Hunter, but, you know, on the take, the big guy, stuff from China and stuff. And, you know, me, Sullivan, you know, I set up this whole Russiagate thing. I mean, I told Hillary, hey, look, this makes sense. Let's do Russiagate. And it's all petered. It's all shown to be a big lie. And as for Blinken, our friend Blinken, just remember, Mr. President, you may not remember this, but Blinken was largely responsible for you winning against Trump in 2020. Remember that? And Biden said, I don't remember that. Mr. President, don't you remember that 2 weeks before the end of the election, it became known that Hunter Biden's laptop had incredibly scurrilous and all kinds of really bad stuff on it? And don't you remember that Blinken said, I can fix that. I can fix that, Joe Biden. And he reached out and he got 50 former intelligence directors to say, this is a Russian disinformation intelligence operation. Okay. Whoa. When was that? Don't you remember now? Oh, yeah, says Joe Biden. I remember that. Oh, that was right before that last debate. Right. And remember, oh, I remember how I said to Mr. Trump, don't you know? You raised this laptop about my dear son. Come on. Look, don't you know that no fewer than 51 former U.S. intelligence directors or deputy directors have called that a Russian intelligence disinformation operation? Didn't you know that? Come on, you know? Well, it was all fabricated, of course. Blinken, we know, because of testimony by a former acting CIA director, what's his name, Mikey Morrell, in testimony to the Congress, said, yeah, Blinken called me up, and he said, my God, this is inflammatory, this Hunter Biden laptop. How are we going to do this? And Mike Morrell said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And he rounded up these 50 former intelligence officials, added himself 51, and that was what Joe Biden had as the perfect squelch at that debate to Mr. Trump. Don't you know that this was a Russian disinformation op? Don't you know that? Now, I don't know if that helped Biden win the election, but it certainly didn't hurt. And it may have created the edge where Biden will remember that Blinken did that for him, but the rest of the world will remember that under the testimony by Mikey Morrell, before Congress, Blinken was guilty of this, not Russian, but American disinformation operation by, to their extreme discredit, 50 other U.S. intelligence directors or deputy directors or high muckety mucks participating in this ruse. That's interference. That's intelligence officials interfering in U.S. elections in a way that is very reprehensible and that I've never quite seen before.
Yeah. Ray, shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, we've learned that ICC has issued an arrest warrant on Netanyahu. And it's so important, I think. At the same time, we're here in Ireland, Norway, and Spain are going to recognize the state of Palestine. I think it's so important, these two together right now. How do you see the current situation of conflict in Gaza?
The Israelis are isolated in a way they have never been isolated before. Netanyahu and Gallant, the defense minister, are people that warrants for their arrest can be issued. Now, the real surprise here was the fact that the spokesman for Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, immediately said, when he was asked at a press conference, how would Berlin, how would Germany respond to an arrest warrant? And he said, well, we're a country of law. Oh, there you go, back to Chaz Freeman. We're a country of law. And so, yes, we would arrest Netanyahu. Wow! The next day, Scholz said, the arrest warrants haven't been issued yet. So, we have to wait and see, you know. And besides, it won't be me. It will be the German judiciary that decides what to do about this. But, you know, here's the wonderment that the press spokesman of Olaf Scholz immediately issued this statement saying, yeah, we'd arrest this guy if he came, and Gallant as well. The day before, Norway had said the same thing. Then you mentioned Norway and Spain, and who's the other country that is, they're going to recognize the state of Palestine. That's big. But the biggest thing was yesterday, the decision by the International Court of Justice that Israel is indeed guilty of genocide, and they are ordered by a vote of 13-2 to stop it. Not only that, but to let those miles of lined up trucks into Gaza so Gazans don't starve to death. Okay? That's part of the order. Okay? Now, how did the Israelis react to that? Well, you guessed it. They said, no, we're not doing genocide. And some smart lawyers have said, well, if the Israelis tune back their offensive there, maybe it wouldn't be, maybe there may be just less than genocide. Okay. What did the U.S. say? Now, I've been looking all morning to find out what the White House said. I mean, that matters. Okay. They haven't said anything. They had one little sentence here. Oh, yeah. Yesterday they said, the U.S. position is clear and consistent on Gaza. Oh, now, do I expect that Biden, Blinken, and Sullivan will condemn Israel and say, no, you better stop? No, their position is clear and consistent. We hope that not so many people are killed there, but we will continue to give all the arms and weapons the Israelis need to continue this onslaught. Now, who's going to be indicted in world opinion when that becomes clear? I hope I'm wrong about that, but I think the chances are that Biden sees that he cannot defy the Israel lobby, powerful as it is in our country. He needs them, and he needs the really mega donors that are often coincident with the Israel lobby to win the election. And that's what matters to Biden. 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five. He praises Madeleine Albright for saying that was worth it. How many children now killed in Gaza? Well, what are they saying? 36,000 folks in Gaza killed. That's not counting the ones still under the rubble, okay? So how many of those are children? Most people say at least half, okay? So does it have to be 500,000? Can it be less than that? Will the U.S. stand alone? Not even with Germany and Norway in its ranks, and say, no, the Israelis are doing the right thing. But genocide, no, it's not genocide. It's something short of genocide. I don't know. But all the smart people would say, I think, that the U.S. will continue to say vague things like, our position is clear and consistent. We've asked Netanyahu, please don't kill as many people, please. But yeah, we're giving them the weapons with which to achieve that. One slight light on the horizon is that there was one shipment of these 2,000-pound bombs, different from smaller bombs because they can obliterate a whole city block in Gaza, a whole city block, okay. The president said, no, we're going to hold off on this one shipment of those, okay? And why did he do that? He did that because there are people with conscience in our country, the students who are occupying the campuses and who don't think the United States should be supporting genocide, okay? Now, was this a big move? It was a token move, but it betokens the fact that not even the blind leading the blind in the White House can continue to have blinkers on, so to speak, when the campuses are in turmoil and when they have to throw this little Philip. One shipment of 2,000-pound bombs won't go because they can level a whole city block in Gaza. The 500-pound bomb, well, they could do a half a block. We'll let those go, and they are going, and our military is in very close consultation with the Israelis and all that. It all has to do with electoral politics. It all has to do with money. It all has to do with the incredible strength of the Israel lobby that allows the United States and the media that is unduly influenced by this same lobby to deceive the American people into thinking that, well, this is somehow all right, because Hamas is somehow evil, and that it did some dastardly thing on the 7th of October, which in reality pales in significance to what the Israelis have done in Gaza since then.
Yeah. Ray, just to wrap up this session, I want to know, but how do you find the Israeli lobby in the United States? Do you think that they're still supporting Netanyahu and his administration? Because when you consider public opinion outside Israel and even inside Israel, there are many people against this administration. How do you find their policy, the Israeli lobby's policy in Israel? Are they still supporting Netanyahu and his administration, or they're thinking of an alternative in Israel?
Nima, I have to be very frank here. I think the saddest thing of all is that the vast majority of Israeli citizens, not just the government, support the extermination of Palestinians. The polls show that, okay? Now, do they like Netanyahu? No, most Israeli citizens don't like Netanyahu, but he is prosecuting this war, and he has made this devil's agreement with people still farther to the right of him to prosecute that and to exterminate Palestinians. How? Well, the ones that you don't bomb to death, the ones you don't put under the rubble, you starve, okay? Starvation. People talk about famine. It's not famine. It's deliberate starvation. Those trucks are lined up at the entry points to Gaza. They have been for weeks now. They can't get in because the Israelis say no. And when a couple of them got in, some Israeli protesters threw the food off the trucks, and this did not allow them to proceed further into Gaza. This business about the floating pier, give me a break, you know? All Biden has to do is call up Netanyahu and say, look, let those trucks in, for God's sake. They can give 10 times as many shipments in there as this make-believe pier out there in the Mediterranean, for God's sake. And even those have been vandalized on their way into Israel. So what we see here is the influence of the Israeli government and the Israeli people, I dare say, on the AIPAC, on the Israel lobby in this country. You know, there's nobody that knows more about this than John Mearsheimer, a notable professor at the University of Chicago, an author together with Stephen Walt of Harvard, of a book called The Israel Lobby. Now, let me tell you a little illustrative thing about that. When that came out, the history was that Mearsheimer and Walt, two very noted historians and political scientists, international relations, I guess is a better way to put it, but they've been around for a long time, and they are masters of the so-called realist school of political science. I didn't realize it, but I was in the CIA as an analyst. I was part of that realist school. I don't know what the other schools are called. Yeah. Non-realist? I don't know. Anyhow, so they were hired by a prominent U.S. periodical. Hey, please write an article, not a book, but an article on the power of the Israeli lobby. And they did. And they gave the draft to this very prominent magazine. I think it may have been The Atlantic. I'm not sure about that. But they looked at this and read it and, oh my God, oh, look, we'll pay you for what we said we'd pay you, but please take this somewhere else. We can't. So they peddled it around. No one would publish it. So what did they do? They went to the London Review of Books, if I recall correctly. And they, in that case, that was 12 years ago or so, they would publish things like that. They no longer do now, but they would. And they did. So later it became a book. So here's the story. McGovern is traveling down to a place called Springfield, Missouri, to give a lecture on Iraq and what was really the reasons we went into Iraq and so forth. And on the way down, McGovern prints out this London Review of Books article by Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, because he wants to read it. It's invaluable, and he wants to see what they say. So I read the whole thing on the plane, and I was so glad I did, because in the Q&A period, after this major lecture, it was the biggest church, 300 people there in this place in Springfield, Missouri, to listen to me. I don't know why, but Iraq had gone south. They want to know why. Okay, so question from the audience. Have you read that book by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walter about the Israel lobby? And I said to myself, thank you, Jesus. And of course I've read it. I just recently read it. And they said, what do you think about it? So I was very frank. And I said, look, I think it's a masterful piece of work. But it sets out to show that the Israelis, because of their influence in the United States, can get away with murder. And they missed the most convincing, the most telling episode of that real life. And the question is, so what do you mean? What do you mean? I said, well, I mean the USS Liberty. And then I looked at this audience and they're going, and I said, well, how many of you know what happened to the USS Liberty on the 8th of June, 1967 in international waters across from in the Mediterranean Sea across from the Sinai? Three hands go up out of 300, okay? One in the back, one in the middle, one. So I picked the guy in the front. I said, sir, what do you know about the USS Liberty? Ramrod straight he stood. Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, sir, member of the USS Liberty crew. Well, I caught my breath and I said, Mr. Lockwood, would you come up and tell us in a couple of minutes what happened to the USS Liberty? Apparently, only you and two others of this audience of 300 know that. So he came up and he told the whole bloody story about his being the Marine in charge of a whole 15 or 20 member contingent of code break or code listeners and so forth on this intelligence, admittedly intelligence ship. And when the torpedo finally hit, the planes came first, decimated the antennae of the USS Liberty. Then came the torpedo ships. They hit right where all his Marines were serving, killing all but two of them. And Bryce said, you know, fishing the one that was left out, there were two remaining that were breathing on top of the water. And I was able to get one out through the hatch, okay? And then the other one, I had to watch drift out to the Mediterranean Sea through that big hole from the torpedo. And then they closed the latch, for God's sake. And I begged to finally they let me up. I was lucky because I was behind a bulkhead. I was carrying sensitive intelligence material, which I was going to deep six into the Mediterranean when the torpedo hit, okay? And they told all about how U.S. aircraft carriers commanded by the admirals in the Mediterranean Sea sent planes to do battle with those who were attacking this U.S. ship, the USS Liberty, and were called back. Were called back, mind you, by Secretary McNamara, Secretary of Defense. And when Admiral Geis, who was one of these commanders, said, Secretary, I'm sorry, but one of my ships is under fire. I'm going to have to speak to your supervisor. LBJ was right there. Got on the phone and he said, I'm not going to embarrass my best ally there, Israel. You call those planes back or you're fine. Call them back. Okay. 34 U.S. sailors killed, 173 murdered, not murdered, but wounded. The ship limped back to Malta, and then it was destroyed. It was put apart. So what's the point here? The point here was that nobody knew about this, okay, for obvious reasons, the Israel lobby and its control of the U.S. media and its control of the U.S. government. Let's face it, this was a cowardly thing for our president and our secretary of defense not to come to the rescue of a ship that they knew. They knew because one enterprising young sailor from Texas put some bailing wire up and got an SOS out. So they knew it was under attack, okay? And they called them back. So sorry to be so long-winded, but this was such a moment for me. And you know, what it meant exactly was that I found Mearsheimer and Walt very, very good. But if they were out to prove the strength of the Israel lobby, if they were out to prove that the Israelis could get away with murder, including murdering 34 U.S. sailors, well, they missed the best story, for God's sake. And did they know about it? Of course they knew about it. So as soon as I got at home, I called Mearsheimer in Chicago. I said, John, you know, I applaud your work here, but why didn't you include the USS Liberty story? Well, we just, you know, we thought we had enough. We thought we had enough. Well, I don't know what really went on. I'm pretty sure John would have gone with it. Stephen Walt is a little bit more sensitive to prevailing winds. Maybe Stephen didn't want to include that story. In any case, it was not included. And it took Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, sir, to tell that story. It was incredibly moving. And of course, June 8th, what's that? Just 10 days from now? That's coming up, that anniversary. There are still USS Liberty survivors. I know them well. I participated in an award ceremony for that one sailor that I mentioned from Texas who strung up got one of those radars or whatever it is working, communicating things and got the SOS out. He got an award. He got an award from a congressman named Devin Nunes of California. Now, that was an interesting coincidence, but this fellow worked for Devin Nunes, and Devin Nunes learned the story, learned that he was never awarded any kind of recognition for this. And to his credit, Representative Devin Nunes from this Central Valley district petitioned the Navy, and the Navy finally decided that they give this person, his name was Terry Halberdier. He was from Texas. He was a neat guy, and I was there, privileged to meet him when he was given this award out there in Devin Nunes's offices there in Visalia, Central Valley. And then I met not all his, but some of his surviving crew members. We had lunch and then we had dinner, and I heard the whole story. And I want to tell you that if you want to know what PTSD looks like, talk to the USS Liberty alumni, okay? They were forbidden to tell a story. They couldn't tell their wives what the Israelis had done to them, how the Israelis had killed 34 of their crew, wounded most of the others, okay? There were only 300 in the whole crew, 174 were wounded. So, you know, if you want to see what these young people had to deal with, even after surviving this horrible thing where again, the Israelis knew they could get away with murder and did, okay? Look at these folks, meet them. There are still several of them alive. They're good friends of mine now. And if you want to know what it takes to still resist this sort of thing without any help with the major media, well, you just look at these heroes who suffered all this and they were still suppressed and repressed. And I dare say that if 3 out of 300 people knew about the USS Liberty in that one audience in this place called Springfield, Missouri, I dare say, what's that, 1%? Okay. I dare say that it's less than 1% of the American populace that know what happened there. Long story short, yeah, it's the Israel lobby. Yes, it's their control of the media as well as over the purse strings. And yes, John Mearsheimer, as recently as 3 weeks ago, said, yeah, Biden can't possibly change his mind because he wants to win election, and he can't win election without the support of the Israel lobby.